This recording is a service of the Allen County Public Library's audio reading service. It is specifically designed for and directed to people who have visual, physical, learning, or language challenges to reading traditional printed materials.
Welcome to LGBTQ News and Culture. Featuring articles from leading LGBTQ publications, this program offers you a comprehensive look at the issues facing the LGBTQ community and its allies. Available only on the audio reading service, it's LGBTQ News and Culture, coming up next.
Welcome. This is LGBTQ News and Culture, and I'm your reader Jason with the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Today, I'll be reading from the September-October issue of The Advocate, copyright 2025 Equal Pride, starting with Legal Eagles. These lawyers stand between Trump and Trans America by Christopher Wiggins. On paper, they're lawyers. In practice, they're more like a human firewall, a scattered fellowship of civil rights advocates whose work has become a bulwark against the Trump administration's campaign to erase transgender people from American public life. They range in age from their 40s to 60s and live in cities including Boston and Seattle. They spend their days in courtrooms, on Zoom calls, or drafting briefs at all hours of the night. They are queer, transgender, cisgender, parents, introverts, hikers, softball players. One volunteers at a food truck for the fun of it. Others wind down by reading fantasy novels. All of them have grown accustomed to facing judges and government lawyers who often don't understand the very existence of their clients or question that existence. The rarefied group of attorneys stands between America's LGBTQ plus community and an administration determined to write its members out of the law. They'll keep fighting in court, in public, and in quiet conversations over coffee or in softball dugouts, because for them, the work is personal and it's far from over. Shannon Minter, 63, legal director at the National Center for LGBTQ Rights, grew up in a conservative Texas family surrounded by love until the day he came out as a teenager, at first as a lesbian. "I felt like one day my parents loved me, and the next day they didn't," he says. "I felt rejected by God. It was so terrible." Minter later realized he was transgender and transitioned in his mid-30s. He says he spent years drifting, even trying a PhD in English, before switching to law, almost on a whim, after following a friend into Cornell Law School. He discovered LGBTQ plus legal work during a clerkship at NCLR and never left. "I didn't even know that was a type of law you could do," he says. "It was so exhilarating." He has since become one of the nation's foremost attorneys advocating for LGBTQ plus rights. Throughout his career, he has argued landmark cases, including representing Sharon Smith in California's first case allowing same-sex partners to sue for wrongful death. That case, Smith v. Knoller, arose after Smith's partner was killed in a dog attack, and the court ruled that same-sex partners had the same rights as spouses to seek justice for the loss of a partner. Minter also helped lead legal battles for marriage equality that culminated in the Supreme Court's 2015 Obergefell v. Hodges decision, legalizing same-sex marriage nationwide. Now he's one of the lead attorneys challenging Donald Trump's revived ban on military service by out transgender people in Talbot v. USA. What gives him hope? He recalls a recent religious liberty summit at Brigham Young University's law school in Utah. "It was encouraging," he says. "There's a real desire among some moderate conservatives to find a middle ground on these issues. I'm so hopeful we can do that. And Minter has strong words for how the movement needs to adjust. We talk too often in ways that are way too intellectual, way too academic, way too abstract, he says. Transgender people just want to lead their lives, work, go to school, have families, exactly like other people. Sasha Buchert. Sasha Buchert, 59, is a transgender woman and director of the Non-Binary and Transgender Rights Project at Lambda Legal. She transitioned after law school and shifted her career into LGBTQ+ legal work to fight the barriers she once tried to avoid confronting directly. I wandered in the woods for a while trying to find myself, she says. After moving from Oregon to D.C., where she came out, Booker initially avoided LGBTQ+ legal issues during law school. It was too close to home, she says. But after coming out, I became enraged at the barriers trans people face, and that stayed with me. Booker began her career at Basic Rights Oregon and the Transgender Law Center before landing at Lambda Legal. Today, she leads Lambda Legal's work on cases including Schilling v. United States, which challenges the Trump administration's reinstatement of a ban preventing transgender people from serving openly in the U.S. military. Lambda Legal recently announced that it raised $285 million to fight for the rights of LGBTQ+ people. In court, she often finds herself educating judges about the basics of what it means to be trans. That's why we bring in experts, she says. You can't assume a court will understand something they really won't. She finds moments of escape playing softball in DC's LGBTQ+ sports leagues. There aren't enough trans folks taking advantage of queer sports leagues, she says. I'd encourage people to get involved. It's amazing. Jose Abrigo. Jose Abrigo, 42, HIV project director at Lambda Legal, grew up as a queer kid in California in the 1990s, feeling rejected by the world to the point where he tried to die by suicide. I made a promise to myself that I didn't want anyone else to feel as hated as I did, he says. Abrigo's career began in direct services, representing low-income LGBTQ+ people and those living with HIV. Now he's the lead attorney in San Francisco AIDS Foundation vs. Trump and National Urban League vs. Trump, challenging executive orders that strip federal funding from nonprofits if they mention or support transgender people or diversity programs. It's an effort critics say amounts to erasing LGBTQ+ identities and racial justice work from public life. These policies don't target issues in isolation, he says. It's all part of a strategic plan to disenfranchise minority groups. Life is a zero-sum game for them. One group's success depends on suppressing another. He's frank about the stakes. Right now, the courts are the only ones checking executive power, he says. But we can't just rely on them. We have to keep fighting. There's a moral arc, Abrigo says, but it doesn't bend on its own. When he can steal a moment of peace, Abrigo escapes into fantasy novels. Lord of the Rings, Game of Thrones. I'm a huge fantasy nerd, he says, and I love traveling. I'm hoping to finally get to Italy. Lee Nowlin Soul. Lee Nowlin Soul, 41, a senior attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union's LGBTQ and HIV project, never planned to become a lawyer. I thought lawyers were just angry people banging on tables, she laughs. It wasn't until she worked on a political campaign in Vermont that she realized law could be a tool for justice. She joined the ACLU in 2017, and today, Nowlin Soul is leading the ACLU's fight against a new Trump administration policy that blocks transgender, non-binary, and intersex Americans from updating their gender marker on their U.S. passports. The lawsuit argues that forcing people to carry documents that misgender them not only endangers them, but also violates their constitutional rights. A federal judge recently agreed and issued a preliminary injunction against the policy change. It's inconsistent with where the rest of the country is, she says. In 46 states, you can change your driver's license. 44 states let you amend your birth certificate. The Trump administration decided your passport must misgender you, no matter what. Nolan Soule spends much of her time educating judges on transgender identity and the medical facts of transition. We have to break down misinformation, she says. Hormones aren't handed out like candy. This is medical care. Outside work, she soaks up Seattle's rare sunshine and plays board games with her wife and one-year-old son. Jennifer Levi. Jennifer Levi, 60, a senior director at GLAD Law, traces her life's mission back to her childhood in Miami Beach during the late 1970s, when singer and Orange Juice spokeswoman Anita Bryant launched her infamous Save Our Children campaign. Bryant sought to repeal local ordinances protecting gay people from discrimination, portraying them as threats to children. Levi was in seventh grade at the time and recalls crying when Miami-Dade County's gay rights ordinance was overturned, a moment that ignited her commitment to LGBTQ+ advocacy. I didn't really have a sense of my own queer identity, but I was impacted by the work, she says. I probably did have, if not like a conscious sense, but a heartfelt sense that I was queer. At GLAD Law, Levi was hired to focus on transgender work. I had kind of just a few years before that connected to my own transgender identity, she says. I had gone to one of the early conferences in Texas of the International Conference of Transgender Law and Employment Policy. I met Shannon Minter, and I met other leaders of the transgender legal advocacy world, and GLAD Law hired me with that commitment to transgender work. And the rest is history, I guess. Decades later, she's leading Talbot vs. USA with Minter, challenging Trump's renewed trans military ban. The policy maligns honorable transgender service members with falsehoods, she says. It's devastating. When not drafting legal briefs or preparing her for court, Levi has a surprising hobby, volunteering at a food truck. People are surprised when they see me there, she laughs. But it's routine. I meet people and make them happy with food. It's a nice change. Rebel Song. A look back at the activist history and legacy of gay men's choruses. By John Casey. From candlelight vigils to White House performances, gay men's choruses have charted an extraordinary journey over the past half century. It's a series of stories tied together by community, activism, art, and resilience. Born out of a need for visibility and healing, they've become cultural institutions, blending music with unapologetic queerness and social justice. The story begins in 1978 in San Francisco, when activist musician John Reed Sims founded the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus to march in the city's Gay Freedom Day parade. It was the first chorus to include the word gay in its name. But a few months later, tragedy struck. In November 1978, following the assassinations of Supervisor Harvey Milk and Mayor George Moscone, the chorus took to the steps of City Hall to perform Mendelssohn's Thou Lord, Our Refuge at a candlelight vigil. Inspired by San Francisco's example, other choruses formed in the following years. Los Angeles launched its Gay Men's Chorus in 1979. New York City followed in 1980, and Washington, D.C. in 1981. In fact, Washington's chorus owes its origins to a straight ally. The San Francisco chorus toured to D.C., and sang at the Kennedy Center in May or June of 1981, explains Michael Hughes, a longtime member of the Gay Men's Chorus of Washington, D.C. It was the first time a gay arts group performed there. A woman named Marsha Pearson was so moved, she said, "We need this in D.C." She and her sister handed out flyers at Pride and around DuPont Circle. The first meeting of what became GMCW was on June 28, 1981. Soon, the Gay and Lesbian Association of Choruses formed to connect these ensembles. Its inaugural 1983 festival in New York drew over 650 singers from 11 choruses and established a national movement. The AIDS crisis of the 1980s and early 90s devastated the gay community and deeply impacted the choruses. There's a video from San Francisco that still gives me chills, Hughes recalls. About 150 singers are on stage, and as the song goes on, they turn their backs to the audience. They were representing members who died. At the end, only four or five are left facing forward. It's heartbreaking. It's powerful. In GMCW, we lost around 100 members, Hughes continues. We sang at countless memorials. We even started the tradition of releasing balloons during services. In those darkest years, choruses became sanctuaries, offering grief-stricken communities a place to mourn and persevere together. They also reclaimed space in the classical canon, championed queer composers, and transformed music into political witness. From Carnegie Hall to international tours, gay men's choruses brought artistry and advocacy to elite stages. The New York City Gay Men's Chorus made history with its 1981 Carnegie Hall debut, and the Gay Men's Chorus of Los Angeles performed for Presidents Clinton and Obama. Even in D.C., the chorus was attuned to the moment. We were literally on stage, probably during a Christmas concert, when the military ban was rescinded, Hughes remembers. We didn't plan it, but the whole room erupted. It was amazing. For years, the movement celebrated milestone after milestone. The overturning of sodomy laws, the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, the Supreme Court's Obergefell v. Hodges decision that took marriage equality nationwide. But Hughes notes that the current climate is more challenging. Because of all the moves against the LGBTQ+ community by the Trump administration, I would say this is the most difficult period since I've been in the chorus, he says. After so many victories, we're now facing real setbacks. While rooted in gay men's experiences, today's choruses reflect evolving queer communities and identities. It's not just gay men anymore, Hughes says. We have straight women. We have quite a few trans and non-binary members. We're building a space for all. Across the country, choruses now work with schools, offering educational outreach, and commission new works that center LGBTQ+ history and identity. San Francisco's Rhythm, Reaching Youth Through Music program, for example, brings inclusive music to Bay Area students. Gala choruses today includes hundreds of groups across the U.S. and abroad, each carrying forward the legacy of those early pioneers. From a single vigil in San Francisco to global stages, gay men's choruses have proven that music is more than performance. It includes protest, pride, and perseverance. They sang us through the worst of the AIDS crisis, Hughes reflects. They sang us through joy, and now they're singing us through another fight. Sapphic Oasis. The Dinah's creator is looking to pass the torch after 34 years, but promises the storied sapphic event will go on, by Trudy Ring. Since 1991, thousands of queer women and their allies have gathered annually in Palm Springs, California, for the celebrated event known as the Dinah, a series of women-centric pool parties, entertainment, and the magic of affirmation and inclusion. Now the event's creator and producer, Mariah Hansen, is seeking to sell it to another producer, but she says not to worry, the Dyna isn't going anywhere. If no one takes it over, we do have plans to be back in April 2027, Hansen says. But, she adds, it feels like time for her to move on. The Dyna moved to the fall a few years ago for a variety of reasons, but April is the optimum time for it, partly because Palm Springs can remain baking hot into the autumn. The Dyna originally revolved around the annual April Palm Springs Area Women's Pro Golf Tournament, named for entertainer Dyna Shore, as women's golf has a large lesbian following. The tournament has now dropped Shore's name and moved to Texas, but the queer women's party in the desert goes on, having long since taken on a life of its own, separate from golf. I felt it was most important to create a space and a platform for our community to live out loud, all while setting the stage for us to transcend isms, Hansen says, racism, sexism, and more. It is expansive and inclusive, welcoming transgender and non-binary people, plus the occasional cisgender man. If a queer woman wants to bring a friend who's a cis man, we're okay with that, she says. The Dyna still celebrates female centrism, but recognizes a variety of ways to do that. This year's Dyna will run from September 24th through 28th, offering parties at poolsides, one of them L-word themed, and nightclubs, plus a ball at the Riviera Resort. L-Word stars Kate Monig and Leisha Haley will be signing their book, So Gay for You, and will appear at other events during the Dyna. Also set to appear are Princess Nokia, Crystal Waters, Sky Daddy, Only One Theory, Xana, Mariah Counts, Nikki Holland, and many others. Rose Garcia will host the pool parties, joined this year by Casey Clark. And there will be big-name DJs spinning tunes. Hansen and the Dyna have also been generous to LGBTQ+ organizations, including the Los Angeles LGBT Center, the Human Rights Campaign, Equality California, GLAAD, and more. For attendees new to the Dyna, Hansen's advice is pace yourself. If you need some time to rest, you can come back, and the magic will still be there, she says. The Dyna, she hopes, will help those who attend embrace life with a little more courage, a little more acceptance, and tolerance, and bring that home with them. Of 2025, she promises, it's going to be an amazing year. Lesbians, Liquor, and Legacies. The Cruising podcast first chronicled the stories of lesbian bars across the U.S. Now it's uncovering other queer histories. By Alex Cooper. Several years ago, it seemed like the lesbian bar would soon become a relic. The endangered safe space for queer women, however, has made a comeback. Now lesbian bars are seeing a resurgence. But before the lesbian bar renaissance, Sarah Gabrinelli, Rachel Karp, and Jen McGinty began documenting these establishments' history in U.S. society. It was like, what if we all go to all of the lesbian bars in the country, talk to people, document these spaces, and that's our podcast, Karp says. Everyone was crazy enough to be on board with a 30-day road trip. So they set out in a Honda SUV to visit the lesbian bars of America. Out of that journey came season one of the podcast Cruising. Season two featured new lesbian bars as well as histories of closed venues. The most recent season interviews queer history makers and how they created safe spaces. Cruising has featured interviews with Valerie Hughes, a queer woman who dedicated her work as a nurse to supporting those with HIV in the 1980s, Holly Neer, an advocate and pioneer of women's music, and more. Karp says sharing these histories is crucial. We have always been here, she says, adding that so much of queer history has not been super well documented because it's kind of happened under the radar. These bars and clubs have often served as important community hubs, Karp and Gabrielli explain. We just find that over and over again with sapphic spaces, Gabrielli says, of building community within them. These venues hold meaningful stories about how they've changed lives and brought people together. Well, that's all the time we have for today. This has been Jason with LGBTQ News and Culture. I hope you've enjoyed today's reading from the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana.